side, the Commonwealth and the guardian ad litem have worked out so that whatever the time sharing will be, or however you'll yield.
I'm yielding.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough, thank you. And we appreciate the guardian ad litem being involved, all of us. Thanks. All right, Mr. Edwards, with 3 minutes reserved.
May it please the court. Douglas Keith and Alina Keith are ex-husband and wife. They have two children together, Alex and Lucas, both of whom are in students in the Arlington County public system, one at middle school and one in high school. And in the divorce proceeding, or the proceedings associated with it, there is an outstanding custody and visitation order, which is included in the joint appendix.
If I understand your arguments, they're very technical about who can prosecute. You don't dispute anything about the custody and visitation order being violated or anything like that in this appeal.
Right. We're not here to discuss whether or not, you know.
Then you can skip a lot of facts.
Okay. I just wanted to sort of give a little lay of the land as for how we got here. But okay. Fair enough. So yeah, the main issue is whether or not. So it originated September 19th with Douglas Keith filing a petition for a show cause summons in the Arlington Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court on the basis of an alleged violation of the custody and visitation order. And Douglas Keith versus Alina Keith was how it was styled from there on out as a civil case. And indeed, that it stayed that way until, I guess it was June 23rd, when this court made the decision that the opening brief that I filed should be treated as a petition because it should be transferred over to the criminal side.
Well, and the penalty that was meted out by the trial court was a criminal penalty, and it was the kind of penalty that the defendant below was not able to remedy. That person did not hold the keys to the court, and so we're. In the case, even though it started as a civil contempt, the penalty became a criminal penalty.
Exactly. The keys to their own jail is the really great line from, I think, an old Supreme Court case. I think of Gompers was the first one that used it, but I think that
well, criminal contempts can arise from civil orders. You don't have any dispute with that.
Right. The distinction about whether it's criminal contempt or civil contempt is you look at the remedy imposed.
Right. Is there a difference between prosecuting the criminal contempt and filing the show cause to allow the court to be aware that its order has not been followed, and then it's the court?
I think the fact that if it's allowed to proceed, then it would be prosecuting. I mean, I think that in a perfect world, if all had gone as according to the, you know, what the law is, the court would have said, oh, well, any remedy here is necessarily backward-looking. We're imposing punishment for something that has already occurred that cannot be undone. It is necessarily criminal contempt, no matter how we slice it at the end of the day, with punishment. So what needs to happen at this point is it can't go forward here. You can go to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, though, and see if they would like to bring this as a criminal case.
Is it your position that the elected Commonwealth's attorney has to sign off before a criminal contempt order can issue?
Yes.
Then how do you square that with the trial court's ability to summarily impose a criminal
contempt? Summary contempt is a different animal.
Why?
So everything I'm saying is sort of summary contempt being the situation where a judge is seeing all the facts before her, and so there's no need to have a hearing where facts and evidence is brought to the table because it's all been seen and decided upon right then and there. And so that is a situation where it would be considered criminal contempt, but there would be no need for a prosecution because it's a done deal. There's nothing to prosecute. The judge has already made a decision in a summary contempt situation where, you know, you can imagine situations where it occurs, where a defendant doesn't like what, you know, the result is, and maybe says some curse words or something, and you're in contempt. So at that point, all the facts that are, you know, being decided upon are right there in front of the judge to be decided upon. So summary contempt being sort of its own animal of contempt in general.
This process began with a pre-printed form that referenced both criminal contempt and a civil contempt citation, if I recall correctly. Is that right?
Where this process originated in the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court. It was brought under show cause summons civil.
Well, your notice argument, given that your client was the party who initiated the circuit court proceeding and already knew the penalty that had been imposed, why don't you have sufficient notice, given that, it's unusual for the party initiating.
Well, it was still a civil case at that point. It was still being styled as a civil case. It was still Douglas Keith versus Alina Keith. It wasn't the Commonwealth of Virginia versus Alina Keith. It was appealed to the circuit court because, it was a case that we thought should be appealed. And the December 9th motion.
But generally, a lack of notice is, I didn't receive notice this could happen to me. Given what had happened and the appeal, you knew that was a possibility when you filed the appeal. Because, of course, whatever happened in the juvenile court is essentially a nullity,
right.
Correct? I mean, and that was brought about by your affirmative filing of something.
So the October 24th decision, I think we filed the notice of appeal the next day, October 25th. and so I'm not exactly sure when our first hearing in the circuit court was. I could look that up real quick, but it wasn't long after. There was a short period of time because it was the holidays, but it was we didn't have a great deal of time before the case setting in the circuit court, and it was set for December 12th. And so,
your argument is that the Commonwealth's attorney didn't initiate this, but it's a little odd because your client is who initiated the proceeding that's in front of us.
Well, I'm not sure it's fair to say that our client initiated the proceeding by appealing a jail sentence.
But the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court thing goes away, so it's a trial de novo from the beginning with the knowledge that a criminal penalty could result.
So, but what all that can be done at that point from the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court decision is to appeal it, and then at that point, whether it's called criminal or civil, it's going to be called civil because it was called civil in the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court. And so we did file the motion, the December 9th motion, saying, well, hold on, this is not being brought by the Commonwealth.
I think Judge Russell's question is that the foundation or the genesis of this case was your client's filing. That's what started the whole thing.
That's what started at least the order we're reviewing.
By appealing the guilty verdict of the...
And so if that appeal should have been styled as the Commonwealth being a party in interest, weren't you the person to do it?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure that there was a way to do that, to style it as the Commonwealth party in interest on appeal. I mean, the appeal is an appeal de novo, so it's going to necessarily inherit all of the, you know, the attributes, characteristics of you know, whatever, whether it's on the east side of the 6-4 or the west side of the 6-4, was out of my control to my knowledge. Whether I could have done something differently at the notice of appeal stage to...
Could have said something like the Commonwealth's necessary party for just adjudication, which would, what would prevent you from doing that?
Well, I mean, I think that the short answer is that I did some research. I did a lot of research on contempt and sort of
after filing
the appeal, and was like, the more cases I read, the more I'm coming to the conclusion that hold on, this is criminal. This is not civil, no matter what it was called in the court. And so the December 9th motion was sort of, my first codification of sort of learnings on contempt and how...
You raised that in the circuit court?
Yes.
The record is silent there's a reference that there was that you filed a motion to dismiss in the circuit court, and I didn't find anything in the record about what happened, although we see after the fact that there's a civil case number that's assigned to the matter, and that there's a reference that the motion to strike was denied in part and granted in part. Does
right.
it matter? I mean, I
so the The December 12th hearing, that's the final order from the December 12th hearing. And so the December 9th hearing obviously was filed in advance of that. And there is no, we didn't provide a transcript just because, to my view, you know, transcripts are, it's, you know, they're kind of expensive to get. And I mean,
but they're important if you're trying to preserve the record.
Normally they're not more than important. Normally they're absolutely essential. But here, where the question is completely taken off the table of whether or not the actions that Alina Keith took constitute a violation of the outstanding custody and visitation order.
How
and the question only is whether or not this could have been brought in initially by Douglas Keith. I didn't see any need for a transfer.
Well, without an order from the circuit court on the motion to dismiss, and without knowing what you argued at the motion to dismiss, how do we know that the issues that you are raising on appeal are properly preserved?
Well, so the
and
question...
In fact, can we get to it without a specific order on the motion to dismiss? Did you obtain a ruling on the motion to dismiss? And I know that sounds almost idiotic because, well, we have a final order, so definitionally the trial court did not dismiss it.
Did not dismiss it, right.
So we know that, but we don't know the how, the what, the where, or the why.
Well, yeah, we know that the trial court had the opportunity to dismiss it and that they did not dismiss it.
But we don't know the arguments raised at the hearing, and we don't know what arguments that the trial court, what the trial court based its theory on. Did it find that you were technically defaulted because you didn't name the Commonwealth? Did it find that it wasn't necessary for the Commonwealth to be there because it served the purpose of the Commonwealth? We don't know any of that. And isn't that necessary for us to resolve whether the trial court behaved appropriately?
Well, I don't think so, because the December 9th motion, as you'll see, is basically the exact same argument that I'm making here today. It even cites the main case that in Virginia that I would rely on for, you know, a holding of the Commonwealth having to bring a criminal contempt action, and that it can't be brought by a private citizen, it has to be brought by the Commonwealth. So it isn't a situation where, for example, in a motion to suppress where it's a really short and bare-bones motion that says, oh, well, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, and Sixth Amendment violations occurred, but then in the actual motion itself, they only discuss Fourth Amendment. And the lines about the Sixth Amendment and Fifth Amendment violations were just put in there just because why not? Here on the December 9th motion, that's the argument, and that's our contention.
What was done on the merits at the trial level in the circuit court?
So there was a proceeding on the merits. The motion was heard. Of course, you all can't take my word for it. I understand that, but there was a long proceeding on the merits. It was probably like 90 minutes to 2 hours, and then Alina Keith was found on the merits to have been in violation of the custody and visitation order.
And which resulted in your case being dismissed. Is that the terminology, or what? Or did the judge say guilty, not guilty?
The judge found, well, guilty, guilty of being in violation of the custody and visitation order, and imposed 10 days all suspended with a fine and some conditions.
What civil penalty would have afforded the court its dignity in having its order? It seems to me the only remedy available to the court to say, I ordered you to do this, not to do this, you did it. The only remedy available to the court to protect the court's own dignity is some sort of sanction, backward-looking sanction.
I agree.
I
think I've tried to brainstorm to what the judge could have done to make it a civil sanction, but it would be kind of a silly... Like, don't do this.
Well, the case law provides the answer to that, and that is if it is determined to be remedial in nature, it makes it civil.
Right. Well, so if it's civil, it's you're trying to coerce compliance. So again, the contender has the keys to the jail and
encourage
the
compliance. Yeah.
And so, which is there's no way of encouraging compliance with something that's already occurred. So it was almost necessarily going to be a criminal, you know.
You're in the rebuttal time, just so you're aware.
Okay.
Yes, sir. We're in, Mr. Jeff.
Good morning, Your Honor. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth in this case, and for the record, again, the guardian ad litem is present.
Mr. Jeffrey, does, in your view, does this case go out on a deficiency of the record, or does it go out on the merits?
I think you always go to the best and narrowest ground, and what I would suggest to you, Judge Alston, is, and I think you can see this from the cases that I cited on the merits here, courts have grappled with the substantive issue that the defendant is raising, and they've gone different directions with it. So I think this is a particularly good case to invoke the inadequacy of the record, and the inadequacy of the record to show what objection was made at trial and how that was ruled on. So I think the short answer is that this case should be resolved on the inadequacy of the record.
But wait a minute. We have the order. We know that whatever the arguments were, the bottom line product at the circuit court was the circuit court proceeded as a civil case, meted out what appears to be a criminal penalty. It was an indirect kind of proceeding. That is, the events took place outside the presence of the court, so we've got a criminal indirect proceeding. Why isn't it like a couple of union cases that United Steelworkers versus Newport News and Local 333B, where the court has said, you've got to bring the Commonwealth in. The Commonwealth needs to prosecute these things.
Are you asking me a procedural question or a substantive question, or both?
Both.
Okay. Well, first of all, with respect to the procedure, this is what you've got. And this is, I think, on all fours, despite counsel's efforts to argue to the contrary. It's on all fours with Brandon, which essentially stands for the proposition that a written motion in the file, standing alone, is not enough to preserve an issue. And I'll hasten to point out that Brandon didn't just cite the contemporaneous objection rule. It also dealt with the statutory 801-384. So, and that was an argument that was made that just putting that written motion in the record was adequate to preserve.
This is a little different in that there's no dispute that a hearing took place. We just don't know. The trial judge never issued a written order ruling, which means he never ruled, even though we know it wasn't dismissed.
We know it wasn't dismissed. That's correct. But again, your case law says you can't rely on the representations of counsel. What we do know that the court ruled on was there was a holding in contempt, and the order also said that the motion to strike was denied in part and granted in part. Now, I'll point out what I pointed out on brief, but I picked up on something that I think is perhaps even more illuminating on that point here, which is this was called a motion to dismiss, not a motion to strike, which generally obviously goes to the quantum of the evidence. But I would point you back to, and again, without a transcript, we can't know for sure what happened. But if you look at page 6, which is the document that Mr. Keith filed in the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, you'll see that there were two separate incidents referenced there. And then ultimately, when this got to the circuit court judge only made a finding with respect to the June 22, 2016 incident, not the September 15, 2016 incident. So what I would suggest to you is, but based on this record, that my theory that was a quantum of evidence objection is even more compelling in light of that evidence in the record. But we have no evidence that the court was alerted to this and it had an opportunity to rule on it. And I think that's the essential point of Brandon. I would suggest to you it was the essential point of Commonwealth versus Hilliard, which I also cited on brief, where the written motion addressed a constitutional issue which was not brought before the trial court.
Are you suggesting that the circuit court was never apprised of Mrs. Keith's position that this was a criminal matter and so the Commonwealth needed to be involved?
If you're asking me if I know the answer to that question, I'm not sure I know the answer. I know what before you with respect to the record, and that's all you've got under Smith and its progeny.
What about the fact that if it was her position that the Commonwealth was a necessary party, she didn't give notice to the Commonwealth?
You don't have that in the record either.
Well, I've got the notice of appeal, and it doesn't name the Commonwealth.
No, and in fact, I don't want to go to another issue, but as far as the inadequacy of the record, it seems to me it's manifest here. There's no, and that's why we have a rule for transcripts, and with all due respect, I mean, I get this. I've been out of private practice for 20 years now, so it's a little dormant in my mind, but I know transcripts are expensive. That's one of the reasons we have this mechanism of a statement of facts. There's nothing in this record indicating there was ever even an effort to get that, if I'm recalling correctly. We just don't have it. If the manuscript record showed that this was, motion was actually ruled on. Now, I might have some specificity issues, but...
Well, isn't it enough if the motion was raised, the motion was filed saying the Commonwealth is a necessary party, and we see the resulting order, don't we have enough to deal with whether or not the Commonwealth is required to be a part of this?
No. Because this issue, and I know there's been some dispute in the reply brief as to whether this was a due process issue or some kind of state law issue, which I guess I can get to that in a moment, but we don't have any indication any of this was argued, Judge Huff. And with all due respect, you know, this area of the law is a morass. You know, there's after, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, Witan, the Supreme Court of the United States case, we've had courts go in different directions on this, whether there was a due process right. And I can address why I think it's a due process issue as opposed to some state law issue if you'd like, although I would point out that notwithstanding his efforts to disavow this now, the very closing page of the opening brief here said that there was a due process violation. That's why I treated it that way.
But let me follow up on that a little bit. And hypotheticals sometimes help us understand the context of things. Suppose we had a case, not this case, where a person came to this court and said, my wife, or not my wife, but my next-door neighbor brought a petty larceny charge against me. And the Commonwealth wasn't there and prosecuted the petty larceny charge, and the judge gave me 10 days in jail with 10 days suspended because of some dispute that not my neighbor and I were having. And there was no transcript, there was no record, but all we saw was that we've got a file that says that the defendant was there, the next-door neighbor was there, and nobody from the Commonwealth was there. And obviously the Commonwealth has an obligation to prosecute those kinds of offenses. From that bare record, could we get to the question of whether or not that case was appropriately brought up to appeal to question the appropriateness of that conviction and prosecution?
No, you can't, because you still don't have a record that the trial judge was ever asked to rule on it, Judge Alston. I mean, I think your question actually suggested to me one of the unintended consequences, so I'll go ahead and address this.
Sure.
But one of the unintended consequences of what he's asking you to do is that we have a statutory provision, which I cited on brief, I think it's 15.2-1627, which allows Commonwealth's attorneys to opt out of misdemeanor cases. If you hold what he's asking you to do, and this would be true of whether, because as I pointed out in brief, there's an old Attorney General opinion on this, and I think that it's legally correct. I mean, the court can read it and could disagree with me if you so choose, obviously. But the unintended consequence here, whether it sounds in state law or due process, I think would be to say that there's something wrong with that presumptively constitutional statute, presumptively correct statute. Because if what he's saying is true, using your petty larceny example, that's why I launched off on this, we could never prosecute, a case could never be prosecuted, even though that statute clearly tells us the General Assembly says it can.
Because theoretically, without a record to verify it, the Commonwealth might well have opted out of that case.
Might well have. And again, full circle to what I was saying a minute ago, we don't have any indication under your hypothetical. I understand the record comes up and we know that the Commonwealth's attorney wasn't a participant, but that's only part of it because, you know, in light of the...
Well, do we know that the Commonwealth's attorney didn't appear on December the 9th without a statement of facts or a transcript?
No, and that was on my like eighth reason I was going to give you, and I didn't know that I was ever going to make it there. But no, we don't know. We don't know anything about what happened at this proceeding. And that's really, we don't know that the motion was brought forward. We don't know that it was ruled on.
The position that an elected Commonwealth's attorney or a deputy, an assistant Commonwealth's attorney, somebody has to be present for a criminal prosecution, am I correct that I can go to any general district court in Virginia just about and see all kinds of various offenses be prosecuted without a lawyer for the Commonwealth being present?
I know Judge Alston used to be a defense attorney. I'm going to go based on my own practice at the risk that he's going to tell me I'm wrong. But at least in jurisdictions I was in, I think that's
true. I would never suggest you're wrong. Just incorrect.
Just in terms of what the practice is. But no, I certainly, again, I've been doing this for 20 years, so it's been a while, but no, that is something you see. I mean, I think, and it makes me cringe given the technical aspects associated
with it. You're correct. You see police officers being responsible for generating cases through. You see pro se individuals. You see judges taking the cases up on their own. You see the prosecutor sometimes come in and say, "Judge, we're not going to be involved in this case." You have all kinds of scenarios that happen throughout the Commonwealth, depending on how well the Commonwealth's attorney's office is funded in most instances.
Again, which I think takes me back. I mean, we've had a legislative decision made on that basis, and again, as I pointed out, there could be a huge unintended consequence if you went the direction that he wants you to. And I was going to say, I think I've even seen DUIs prosecuted that way. I'll use the term in quotes, and that to me is frightening, just because all the technical aspects and things that can go awry, even with a seasoned prosecutor who stays up on the developments in the area.
And assuming this is a criminal offense with a criminal sentence, it's a misdemeanor, is it not?
That is what the Attorney General opinion says, and I agree with the reasoning. It's upwards of 30 years old at this point, but I think it's still, the statutes are still substantially similar, if not exactly similar, and I think the reasoning is sound.
And does legislative acquiescence, if the General Assembly hasn't moved to address that Attorney General's opinion, apply?
I think we've got cases that say that. I think there may be also some cases that suggest that you're not absolutely bound by the Attorney General opinion. So, with this statutory interpretation stuff, I guess sometimes you can go in both directions. But I think, Judge Russell, if you'd like, I can try to find the cases that are out there. But I think there are some cases that, if nothing else, suggest that it's very compelling that the General Assembly didn't act. But, again, we've got that legislative policy behind the statute, and that is an important one. I hope I've answered all the questions about the inadequacy of the record. There were some cases cited on reply. If you'd like, I can address those. But I do think that the most specific holding to this case is Brandon. I think it's directly on point. And I cited a recent case from this court as well with respect to a dearth of statement of facts. Browning, I think, was the name of it. I think that's helpful. Again, I'll point you back, because I think the Supreme Court sort of presaged what it was going to say in Brandon. That snippet I cited from Commonwealth versus Hilliard, where the one constitutional argument was in a written motion but was never brought forward for a ruling, whereas the other one was, the Supreme Court said that's not before us. So that's really what you've got here. It's kind of a combination of the inadequacy of the record and, again, the inadequacy to demonstrate that there was a ruling below.
Even if there's a need for some clarification on this issue of what's required in this kind of contempt proceeding, this is not the case to deal with it in you.
No, I think it's a terrible vehicle, Judge Huff, and I'm going to be honest. I was reading some of the cases that because I think there were some cited in my brief that went both directions on this issue. And you would see if you looked at those that oftentimes the court spent quite a bit of time delving into what transpired exactly below, and at least there was some suggestion, at least in some courts, that it would not be a per se rule that you really need to see what happened, and you don't have that here. So I think that is a fundamental problem in this case, and obviously I cited a constitutional case on judicial restraint. Try to avoid hard constitutional issues if you can. As I've indicated on brief, both with Wheaton and that Robertson dissent from the denial of cert or dismissal of the case, that the issue is clearly still percolating in the U.S. Supreme Court in terms of whether there's a due process problem. Wheaton said, we're not going to reach that, we're not going to touch it, it's going to be supervisory authority, and that really is the last word that's binding at all on anyone. And as you can see from my brief, courts have sorted this out differently. And for that reason, I think it's a terrible vehicle to use the term I think the U.S. Supreme Court used. This is one that ought to percolate a little bit in the courts, particularly when you've got a case like this where there's just no record at all.
Even though it's apparent that this was never transferred to the criminal side and the Commonwealth was not brought in, it still would be inappropriate, you submit, to reverse and remand for further proceedings if the Commonwealth be so inclined.
I think that's right, Your Honor, because unlike, well, I'm assuming the issues were preserved in cases like Powell and Steinberg. Steinberg, the court actually affirmed for substantive reasons, but No, the trial court, we don't have a record that the trial court ever had an opportunity to rule on this, and that is the core of the contemporaneous objection rule. You know, I would point out, too, that the defendant was clearly treating this as criminal for reasons other than what I cited as far as the motion to dismiss. On page 9, there was the notice of hearing in the J&D court styled as Commonwealth versus Ms. Keith. And also in the appearance of counsel, although if I could have just 2 seconds, I'll wrap
yes,
up.
Sir, yes.
In the appearance of counsel form on page 15, that's the notice of appearance of counsel that was simultaneous, I think, with the notice of appeal. That one was actually styled as Commonwealth versus Elena Keith as well. And that was filed on October 25th, several weeks before the actual hearing in circuit court. So this suggestion that he wasn't on notice about the nature of the proceedings just fails. I address the third issue on brief, unless the court has questions on that. I'll submit.
Hearing none. We thank you, Mr. Jeffrey. Mr. Edwards, where in the record do we find that the trial court was apprised of the need to make the Commonwealth a party?
Well, the motion on December 9th is the first time that the issue of whether or not it's proper for this type of proceeding, which no matter, it was going to be a criminal contempt proceeding because there was just no other way for the outcome to come out, needed to be brought by a Commonwealth attorney. When this was the first time it had come up.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Jeffrey has cited a statute that says for misdemeanors, which let's assume for a moment that that's what contempt of a court's order would be in the criminal contempt context. Says the Commonwealth's attorney doesn't have to appear. He can waive and go on without him. If that statute is constitutional, I mean, it seems to me your argument that they can't do that would render that, you're saying that statute has to be unconstitutional.
So having a speeding ticket and then going to court and there not being a prosecutor there and you just giving your testimony before a judge is a very different animal than a private citizen originating and prosecuting from soup to nuts what is a criminal proceeding.
But the statute says the Commonwealth's attorney doesn't have to appear for any, can waive for any misdemeanor. And you have conceded, your argument, at least in response to my first question, was your position was that a Commonwealth's attorney has to be there.
Is that statute taking misdemeanors where jail time is not on the table, because I'm not aware in my experience of that ever being a situation where a Commonwealth attorney was not involved.
I believe it's for all misdemeanors, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what the statute reads. It's all misdemeanors. And the cloud comes up as to whether or not the person who is on the other side, with jail being on the table, is entitled to counsel, and obviously that individual is, which is a different inquiry as to whether or not the Commonwealth needs to participate in the prosecution.
And so, assuming the statute is how Judge Austin and I have represented it to you, is it your position that that statute is unconstitutional?
So if it's still being originated by, it's still a being brought by the Commonwealth of Virginia, right? So it's still a criminal, according to Hoyle, criminal acting, that it is redressing a public wrong, and the plaintiff essentially is the Commonwealth of Virginia. Practically speaking, I can't even imagine of how that would work for a trial of a misdemeanor with jail time on the table without a prosecutor. I don't know who would call witnesses, who would, I don't know how it would work. It
happens every day.
The only way that you're going to be able to get there, and I think the answer to Judge Russell's question from you has to be yes, that statute is unconstitutional abdication of prosecutorial responsibility by the government. I think that's the only way that you get there. Similar to those HOV cases that we saw a while back where there was a claim made by then Attorney Bernard that these kinds of cases were an abdication of constitutional authority to a non-governing entity. I think that's the only way you get there.
But you don't need to accept Judge Alston's legal advice.
No. Just throwing it out there for you.
If I may, the Commonwealth said that the Brandon versus Cox case was on all fours. I addressed that case in my response to the motion to vacate, and so I won't beat a dead horse, but it's very different in that it was the motion for reconsideration. And indeed, under the language that the court uses in characterizing the claim, it would have come out, it would have been on my side on this, and that it says the purpose of Rule 5.25 is to ensure that the trial court has the opportunity to rule upon an argument. The record must affirmatively demonstrate that the trial court was made aware of the argument. Now, it's difficult for me, if you were explaining this situation to a man in the street, would you be able to say that the court was not made aware of the arguments presented in the December 9th motion, that they did not have an opportunity? Did it get lost in the file? Or it's difficult to even imagine how you can sort of twist that legal standard, and which is put into play in a case that I do think is on all fours, or closest to being on all fours with our situation, is the case that I cited in my reply brief, Scott versus Commonwealth, where there was a motion where he addressed the a double jeopardy claim and then a single larceny argument, but then in the motion itself, they only argued the double jeopardy, and the court held that the single larceny was still, it was still preserved because it had been in the motion.
We understand your position. We've run out of time. The case is submitted. We'll step down and greet counsel.
Okay.